Obamacare. Tornado. Obamacare-nado. Just when you thought it was safe to go to the doctor, a rising tide of healthcare costs.
The message war intensifies in the run-up to the opening of new health insurance exchanges. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. More than 100 congressional bodies theoretically oversee the Homeland Security Department. But it doesn't seem any of them actually do it.
Pulling these executives in, grilling them, that's the way we do it with the Department of Defense. That's the way we do it with Justice. That's the way we do it with the State Department. We need to do the same thing on Homeland Security.
And how can you spot fake reviews online?
Pretty good cue of deception is that people use a lot of words in their reviews.
That and more coming up.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Now, from the annals of efforts to get toothpaste back in the tube, let's consider the information war raging over a three-year-old law that some lawmakers still can't seem to accept. Among them, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, whose unofficial filibuster lent him cult status in some political precincts this week.
If we continue doing this long enough, we may have facial hair on the floor of the Senate.
His 21-hour philippic against the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, ranged near and far from Star Wars to Dr. Seuss to Duck Dynasty.
This is a show about a God-fearing family of successful entrepreneurs who love guns, who love to hunt, and who believe in the American dream. It's something that, according to Congress, almost shouldn't exist. So I want to point out just a few words of wisdom from Duck Dynasty that are probably good for all of us to hear.
Although he defied the GOP leadership with his stunt, he stands with his party in opposing the law, which it is, though Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and Minority Whip John Cornyn sometimes still call it a bill. When they heard that the National Football League might partner with the government to spread the word about next Tuesday's opening of health insurance exchanges under the law, the senators wrote the football commissioner, quote, "Given the divisiveness and persistent unpopularity of this bill, it is difficult to understand why an organization like yours would risk damaging its inclusive and apolitical brand by lending its name to its promotion." It was a slam tackle, and the NFL caved.
I had not seen something like that before.
Chuck Todd is the political director for NBC News.
It was this letter that essentially, I guess one person would say, warn the NFL that if they got involved, it would politicize them. Others might call it a threat.
That said, some of the individual teams, sports teams, have said that they're going to sign on in their states.
Sandia Somershaker covers the issue for the Washington Post.
Like here in Maryland, you've got the Ravens saying that they're going to go ahead and help promote Obamacare in Maryland.
But then Maryland is friendly to Obamacare. Oddly, even in this interconnected age, what you know or think you know about Obamacare may depend on where you live.
The administration has said it's going to rely heavily on the states, which have already started putting ads out on television stations. And they're also funding a program called the Navigator Program. These are people who will be essentially paid through federal dollars to be available basically 24/7 to help walk people through their options. And that's primarily how they're going to get the word out.
Yeah, about those navigators. At least 17 Republican-controlled states have taken steps to rein them in. Florida's Department of Health ordered 60 county health agencies to bar navigators from their premises. Oklahoma's insurance commissioner says that if the navigators perform any of the duties of state-licensed insurance agents, quote, "we will put a stop to it." Indiana is requiring navigators to take a state exam, undergo a background check, and pay up to $175 for a license. Missouri and Ohio, among others, have passed laws restricting what navigators can say.
if you live in a blue state, your experience of learning about the law is going to be a lot different than it will be in another state.
For instance, in blue states, ads for the new insurance exchanges under Obamacare sound like this.
To care for each one, every daughter and son, live long in Oregon.
In red states, you're more likely to hear something like this.
Obamacare. Tornado. Obamacare-nado.
Normally, this would be pretty straightforward.
That's President Obama talking about his landmark law, not bill, this week at Bill Clinton's annual Global Initiative Forum in New York.
But let's face it, it's been a little political, this whole Obamacare thing.
Kind of an understatement.
Those who have opposed the idea of universal health care in the first place and have fought this thing tooth and nail through Congress and through the courts and so forth have been trying to scare and discourage people from getting a good deal. And some of you may have seen some of the commercials out there that are a little wacky.
Oh, I see you chose to sign up for Obamacare.
Yeah, it's actually my first time here.
Most notoriously wacky, if that's the word, are the ones depicting a monstrous grinning Uncle Sam in a doctor's office, donning rubber gloves prior to probing a young man's, or as in this ad, a young woman's private places. The Uncle Sam ads are made by Generation Opportunity, a Koch brothers-funded group campaigning for people, especially young people, to opt out of Obamacare. Young people are crucial to the law's success, since the insurance companies can't cover older and sicker people without younger and healthier people sharing the costs. Generation Opportunity has planned a 20-college tour to throw pizza parties and parlay the message, "Just say no." Evan Feinberg, president of Generation Opportunity, on its depiction of Uncle Sam.
Well, this ad is meant to be a satire. It's a satire that is all too real, though, because on the exchange, we're going to have all of our data, including specific things like whether or not we're sexually active, being put into a massive federal data hub.
The idea here is to frustrate the economics of Obamacare by reducing the number of young people in the program whose premiums actually subsidize the lower premiums for older Americans?
No, not at all. Our goal with this campaign is to educate young Americans. Our experience with young people across the country has been that they think they are compelled to buy insurance no matter what. The law very clearly gives them the ability to pay a small penalty and buy health insurance, but is actually going to be cheaper and a better deal for them.
How does that work out? The insurance is far more expensive on the private market than even the higher rates that young people would pay under Obamacare.
According to the government released data this week, the lowest cost plan available on the exchange is going to be at least 2 to 3 times more expensive what you can currently get on the private market. So if you take a look at, say, Miami, Florida, a premium for an individual in Florida right now can be as low as $62 on the individual market.
But it's not just the size of the premium, it's the amount of coverage that it buys. The $62 private insurance that you get does not cover hospitalization. So are you not comparing apples and oranges? In fact, are you not comparing apples and watermelons?
I'm comparing apples to apples. That much higher premium isn't buying better health care coverage. It's paying for an older, sicker population's health care. That's why they need young, healthy people to sign up.
What if they opt out of Obamacare and, like tens of millions of Americans, can't get private insurance or can't get insurance that meets the level of coverage that the Affordable Health Care Act provides and then get sick?
You know, 96% of young people that are uninsured don't have a chronic condition. So it's probably not going to hurt most of them if they don't have insurance. But the responsible thing to do is to buy catastrophic coverage to prevent any unforeseen costs.
Is Generation Opportunity a grassroots group?
Yes, we're a grassroots organization that seeks to empower young Americans to fight for their economic freedom and their future and prosperity.
Where does the lion's share of your funding come from?
We have many committed supporters, and we're grateful that there are so many folks in America who believe that the next generation of Americans need to be able to live the American dream and want to fight with us to empower them.
Where does the lion's share of your funding come from?
Look, like many nonprofits, we respect the privacy of our donors, and we're grateful that they continue to support our efforts to fight for the future of this country.
You're aware of the Politico article that, based on IRS documents, traced the funding back to an organization controlled by the Koch brothers. I'm just trying to clear up that point.
We disclose the information required of us. Again, we respect the privacy of our donors, and we continue to be grateful for all those that are committed to fighting with us to help empower the next generation of Americans to fight for their economic future and prosperity.
Evan Feinberg is president of Generation Opportunity.
Chuck Todd, chief White House correspondent for NBC News, observes that even though the legislative war was won long ago in Washington, a decidedly unequal battle for hearts and minds continues to rage across the country.
The ratio of anti-healthcare advertising versus pro-healthcare advertising is something like 5-1. Now, this year you have seen the president's political arm, Organizing for America, spend some money on advertising trying to push back on the ads that you were describing, trying to rally supporters of the president to call Congress and say, don't play these games, things like that. But what they haven't done, and I've been surprised at it, there haven't been education campaigns on simply the law itself.
Why do you think there hasn't been?
We can go back to 2010, right after the law was passed. Democrats running for re-election were scared of the issue. They didn't spend any money advertising on it. They just hid from it in political ads. The Republicans running against them were more than happy to fill the vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one explanation, right? It was short-term political nervousness. So Democrats begged the White House not to talk about it. The White House went dark. And, you know, the president himself, I mean, if you look at his reelection campaign in 2012, he would tout it, but he wasn't explaining it.
Now, you got a lot of flack last week, Chuck, for saying that it wasn't the media's job to inform people about Obamacare.
Well, that isn't quite what I said.
What you actually said was that the president hadn't done a good job of selling the law to the public and that it wasn't the media's job to sell the president's law. But what is the media's role in educating people about the law, especially in light of the successful messaging by Republicans against it?
I tell you what I think the media's role is. It's something that we've had in the works. Basically, we're spending a whole week in the run-up to the opening of this and during the opening explaining the law, but explaining the law in a consumer fashion. If you want people to listen to information, you got to take the politics out of it. In this case, you essentially say, okay, what are these exchanges? How do they work? Now, what got misinterpreted about what I said is I said, I know that there is this feeling out here that somehow the media should be the one to push back on this PR campaign by the Republicans. But, you know, can the media fact check an entire news organization?
I know.
But the fact of the matter is, now hang on a minute, because I know I got a lot of grief for this, but I really think people didn't understand what I was saying. Somebody took this and then just assumed it meant, oh, we don't think that the media is calling out the lies of the Republicans on this. My point was, at the end of the day, these folks, they're not speaking through the media, the Republicans, right? They're buying this advertising. They're doing this. My point was, they're treating it like a political campaign. The White House is not treating it like a political campaign. The President of the United States has won an election twice. They know how to run a political campaign. They just haven't run one on health care.
The Kaiser Family Foundation did a poll that found that 51% of respondents felt they didn't have enough information.
Right.
Do you lay that entirely at the feet of the White House?
You can lay that at the feet of a lot of people. Is it the White House? Is it the entire Democratic Party? Is it the Republican Party? It's everybody that's been involved in this healthcare issue. Is it because there is confusion sometimes in the decisions that are made? And is it the media? I think we're all a part to blame in this. I'm not going to sit here and say we're not. There's no excuse to me for an American to claim they're uninformed. All this information is available.
You've said that the White House made a mistake in embracing the term Obamacare.
I think a complete mistake. I think it politicizes it. Puts people in thinking in a blue shirt or a red shirt. You know, this is about health care, not the president and not a ballot box.
Personally, I think the media have a little more to answer for here, because the political opponents of the Health Care Act have been free to set a tone that suggests that the law is somehow still in play, as if a duly elected Congress didn't pass it or a duly elected president sign it. It's a fantasy, acted out in endless votes for repeal or lately by bullying the lily-livered NFL, that elicits little more than cynical smirks from the media. But our press is free only because the founders believed it would safeguard democracy. And in times like these, that means safeguarding reality, too.
Coming up, more tales from our seemingly ungovernable border.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. On the Media is supported by The New School, offering graduate programs in media studies and media management. These flexible cross-disciplinary programs are designed to carefully balance theory and practice so students are fully engaged with current media scholarship, as well as the latest tools of media production and management. The programs can be completed on campus in New York City, online, or in a combination of on-campus and online study. More information about the New School's graduate programs in media studies and media management is available at newschool.edu/media NYC.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last week on our show, producer Sara Abdurrahman described what happened when she, along with her friends and family, were detained at the border after returning from a wedding in Toronto. They were held for 6 hours in a freezing cold room. Their phones were confiscated. One in the party was subjected to invasive questions about their religious practices, and none was given an explanation. The story garnered many, many comments on our website, like this one from Nick in Boston, who wrote, "I don't like where I see us headed. We are one serious terror attack or some other catastrophe away from a total police state here." A commentator identified only as Ash wrote, quote, "I travel internationally a lot, and this sort of abuse at the border is becoming more commonplace and more widely accepted. I applaud OTM for addressing this issue. Like all abuses of power, it thrives in darkness." Others suggested that we should just accept this as an unfortunate new reality. Commentator Hasters wrote, quote, "The majority of terrorist attacks are committed by Muslims who are otherwise indistinguishable from their religious brethren. If you don't want to be targeted, then change your name and stop practicing Islam. Don't blame the CBP for being curious when carloads of potential terrorists come through a checkpoint at the same time." But the prevailing response was one of frustration with the lack of transparency and oversight at our borders. Moonbat from New York City wrote, quote, "I find this outrageous and appalling. Public servants ought to be accountable. How about elected officials? Are they open to calling for hearings? Which committee is responsible for providing oversight?"
While Sara was reporting the piece, she was unable to get direct answers to her questions from any of the government agencies she contacted. We followed up with requests this week to the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency, but again, no response. The CBP is huge. It employs over 58,000 employees, but it's just one part of a much, much larger organization, the Department of Homeland Security. And who has oversight over DHS? Well, that would be the U.S. Congress. But with more than 100 congressional committees and subcommittees currently claiming jurisdiction over the DHS, former Congressman Lee Hamilton, co-author of a recent report calling for reform of the DHS, told us, the more overseers, the less oversight.
Nobody focuses on the big picture. The people in the department spend more time responding to congressional requests than they do in doing their jobs in Homeland Security. You get all kinds of overlap in the roles of the committees. The problem is confusion, basically.
You wrote that the complexity of the current system leads to gridlock, but do you have a specific example of the kind of gridlock you mean?
Congress has not passed a cybersecurity bill. Left it up to the president to do it. That's not the best way to handle that kind of a problem. They've had very little work on dealing with things like cargo being shipped into the United States. We don't know what's in the holds of a lot of ships. General aviation, as opposed to commercial aviation, is not scrutinized carefully. In other words, If you can get on a private jet, you just walk in the terminal and climb aboard. No security of any kind. There are 75 biological threats. We don't have any sense of priorities among them. There are all kinds of gaps in homeland security under the present system that I think have a better chance of being corrected if the Congress is doing a proper job of robust oversight. Pulling these executives in from the department, grilling them, that's the way we do it with the Department of Defense. That's the way we do it with Justice. That's the way we do it with the State Department. We need to do the same thing on Homeland Security.
Is the process bogged down in partisan conflicts?
I don't think that's the chief problem. This is more organizational. When we began to put so much focus on Homeland Security, created a new department, everybody wanted to get into the act in the Congress and have some influence on it. All kinds of committees began to assert jurisdiction. It grew like topsy.
Do you think some sort of change in congressional oversight of the Department of Homeland Security is even possible in the relative short term? Or do we have to wait a generation?
I don't think you have to wait a generation. At least I hope not. The question of jurisdiction comes up at the beginning of every new Congress. The leaders of the Congress, and it's principally their decision, have to be made aware that the American people will be more secure if the Congress steps up to its responsibilities and does a good job of oversight. And that means adjusting the jurisdictions of the committees, among other things, so that you don't have this plethora of committees and they can do a much more focused, concentrated job on Homeland Security.
The oversight apparatus grew like topsy. The organization itself did too, particularly the CBP, Customs and Border Protection Agency. It's grown so fast that the ACLU claims it's now the largest law enforcement agency in the country. And so even within the agency itself, there is no oversight as to not just its priorities, which Congress seems to care about, but its conduct. Is there any congressional committee responsible for overseeing the conduct of agents at the border or even of the office that is supposed to monitor that conduct?
Oftentimes the bureaucracy, because of its bigness, its indifference, whatever the problem is not responsive. That's not an unusual problem in government. But the Congress has to bear down on the DHS in oversight hearings where the conduct of the DHS agents have been irresponsible, have not been sufficiently sensitive to the privacy and civil liberties of Americans. Congress can do that pretty well if they're on their job.
So what you're saying is that if you can't get anywhere using the channels that have been supposedly established for you within the executive branch, oftentimes you can't actually have an impact as a constituent.
Absolutely. If I were mistreated at the border, I'm from Indiana, I would march myself right down to the office of Indiana senators and Indiana congressmen. I would go to my representatives. I'd say, look, this is outrageous. I was treated poorly. I tried to get it corrected. They didn't do anything about it. I want you to write a letter to the Secretary of DHS. I want you to make sure that in hearings, the bureaucrats are asked about this and why it happened. If you're a member of Congress, you also talk to your colleagues in trying to move this.
In response to our producer, Sara Abdurrahman's experience at the border, we've gotten comments from people around the country. Does it work if you're approaching your congressman on behalf of someone else?
There's always more political pressure in greater numbers. So you want to organize the people who are complaining. You want to contact as many members of Congress as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes members of Congress will be very receptive and they'll really battle for it. Other times they'll ignore it. That's why we have elections.
Is there any particular committee, given that there are so many, that would be most likely to respond to something like this?
That would not be easy to do with the current proliferation. What I would do is go through my congressman, and that's what your people ought to do, because then the congressman can guide you to the proper committee. Pressure, that's what you have to do. You have to create pressure in the Congress and pressure against the DHS to perform properly. That's part of the process. It happens every single day, or at least it should, in a representative democracy.
Thank you so much, Congressman.
Surely.
Lee Hamilton is a former member of Congress and is currently a member of the U.S. Homeland Security Advisory Council. Our producer, Sarah Abdurrahman's incident, happened at the border, but it seems a checkpoint can be just about anywhere. Terry Bressy regularly travels between the University of Arizona Tucson, where he's staff engineer at its Lunar and Planetary Lab, and Kitt Peak National Observatory, 56 miles away. He takes State Route 86, which runs east-west and neither intersects with the border or any road coming from the border. And yet since 2008, he estimates he's been stopped over 300 times at immigration checkpoints. Each time Bressy is stopped, he's asked if he's a U.S. citizen. In fact, he is. But each time, he refuses to answer. For his own protection, he began videotaping his interactions with border agents. And those videos have become something of an internet sensation.
Are you a U.S. citizen?
What's the purpose of the stop, sir?
Are you a U.S. citizen, sir?
Who's authorized this checkpoint?
Department of Homeland Security. Are you a U.S. citizen?
What's the name of the...
I'm asking you a question. You need to answer my question.
Am I being detained?
You need to answer my question, sir.
Am I being detained?
You are free to go once you state your citizenship.
So I'm being detained.
No, sir, you need to say what country
it's
you are citizen.
He wants to play it's simple.
I asked him about bumping up against border control on his commute.
Well, you know, I'm just trying to get back and forth to work on a regular basis there. It's the Border Patrol that keeps on bumping up against me. This is an east-west highway that is over 40 miles north of the international border with Mexico, and it never intersects the border at any point. It's not considered a nexus point for border traffic either, which means basically the vast majority of traffic along that highway is domestic traffic, not border traffic. Nonetheless, the Department of Homeland Security, of which Customs and Border Protection is part of, has diverted these Border Patrol agents away from the actual border to instead stop, seize, interrogate, and search domestic travelers inside the country at this checkpoint that's located near mile marker 147. So that means that people that live and commute in the area have to go through this checkpoint and are seized by armed federal agents on a regular basis.
So when did it hit you that you could say, no, like Bartleby, I prefer not to?
My very first experience at any sort of checkpoint occurred in December 20th of 2002, and it wasn't at an immigration checkpoint. It was actually a tribal police sobriety checkpoint. It was basically within a mile of the current location of the Border Patrol's checkpoint. And coming back from work, I noticed that there are U.S. Customs agents and Border Patrol agents. And when I stopped, I asked the officer, I said, well, what's the purpose of this checkpoint? And he said it was a sobriety checkpoint. And I asked him, well, why are there federal customs and Border Patrol agents working the front line with you? Because federal agents don't have any jurisdiction over local sobriety laws. In short order, I found myself being dragged out of my vehicle, handcuffed, charged with two criminal misdemeanors for not kowtowing to all their demands in a timely fashion. And what I learned during that experience was that police officers will lie with regards to what actually transpires during these types of encounters.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't carrying any video cameras with me at the time. I took it on faith that a law enforcement officer would conduct him or herself reasonably within the boundaries of the law, would answer reasonable questions with reasonable responses, and would conduct themselves in a reasonable fashion. And that was not my experience at all.
So you decided then that you would mount a camera on your car?
Yes. So it's just not my word against an officer's word or an agent's word. It can be independently reviewed by other people to determine what actually happened.
When you get in your car and you go down the road and you know you're going to be stopped, I've seen enough videos to see that you follow a particular script. You're making a challenge.
I'm trying to exercise my rights
You know, I'm not seeking out these checkpoints. In fact, if you know me at all, I go out of my way to avoid scenarios where I have to interact at this level with government agents. I don't like it at all. It's not comfortable for me. It's stressful because, frankly, you never know how they're going to turn out, and they can get violent. So I don't look forward to these.
Have you done a tally of how many hits you've had on your videos?
Oh, geez, I think I'm coming up on 2 million.
Did you anticipate that you were going to become a poster child for this kind of thing? Do you embrace the role?
No, I didn't, and no, I don't. By nature, I'm kind of a private individual, but I find myself in this role because I feel it's an important issue that needs to be addressed. You know, there seems to be this creeping authoritarianism that's taking over this country. The federal government, while they demand transparency from us at every level of our lives, is increasingly hunkering down and refusing to be transparent in its operations. And that, to me, is unacceptable. It's unacceptable that people can be stopped and seized randomly by government agents while just trying to go to work.
Some of the principles this country was allegedly founded on was, you know, the right to be left alone unless you're doing something to either harm somebody else or to harm somebody else's property. And that seems to be something that's harder and harder to find, where you're just left alone to live your life and without having to explain yourself to some random person with a gun and a badge.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you for showing the interest.
Terry Bressy's website is checkpointusa.org. Coming up, how our irrepressible need to pass judgment plays out online. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, developing solutions to support strong families and communities for America's children at aecf.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Monday, the New York Attorney General's office announced that 19 companies would be fined $350,000 for paying for fake reviews on sites like Yelp. The regulators say they caught the fraudsters by posing as a struggling Brooklyn yogurt shop and asking search engine optimization companies to carpet bomb review sites on its behalf. But according to a study that came out this May, many fake reviewers online are not paid by anyone. For reasons best known to themselves, they simply go online to comment about products they have never used and often are none too generous. Duncan Simister, a professor of marketing at MIT's Sloan School of Management, was co-author of the study. Duncan, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Now, how did you put your study together?
We worked with a very large private label apparel company. We obtained all the data describing all of their reviews and also all of their transaction data. So we could match whether a customer who was writing a review had actually purchased the item they were reviewing. So we compared the reviews where there was a matching transaction with the reviews where the customer hadn't purchased the item prior to writing the reviews. And what did we find? Well, interestingly, the reviews without prior transactions were significantly more negative. There were also, you know, big differences in the text itself. Perhaps not surprisingly, if you haven't purchased the item, you can't describe the fit or the feel of the products. They also were full of cues that we would normally, in the psycholinguistics literature, that we associate with deception.
For example?
It turns out that when we're trying to deceive, we feel like we have to be more elaborate than we would normally be. So a pretty good cue of deception is that people use a lot of words in their reviews. And because that takes so much effort, they also tend to use shorter words. So these reviews were not only more negative, but the text of them was significantly different as well.
And in addition to wordiness, contained some just irrelevancies?
Well, it's hard to talk about a product that you haven't purchased. So the reviewers will start talking about things that are really unrelated to the product. You know, they'll start talking about their family and father first sort of took them to the store down the road. So we see a lot of discussion in there that really isn't very helpful.
I kind of get why people will fake a resume or tell war stories or describe the fish that got away. Have you any insight into why people would go online to review a product that they've never purchased?
My first thought was maybe these are angry customers. Maybe they've had a bad service experience and this is some form of retribution. And that turns out not to be the case. We think what's more likely is they actually like the company so much that they're self-appointing themselves as brand managers. And so when they see the firm selling a product that's new or different or they didn't expect to see, they want to give feedback to the firm. And a very convenient way to give feedback is to use this review mechanism.
That sounds, what do you call it? Insane.
You know, there's an old phrase, which is, you know, your best friends are your worst critics. And I think there's a little bit of this going on. I think it's also true that we have to remember how few customers actually write reviews. So, you know, out of 1,000 customers, only about 15 write reviews. And about one of those 15 will write these fake reviews. But the reviews written by those 15 customers are very influential for the other 985 customers. Mm. The fact that the reviews without transactions are more negative lowers revenue for the items by about 1% to 2%. You're thinking 1% to 2% doesn't sound like a lot, but for these retailers, and this is a big deal, taking 1% to 2% off their top line is, you know, has an important impact on them.
So is it vandalism?
I actually think that a lot of the reviewers who are doing this really, they think they've got the best interests of the company at heart, ironically. They're very good customers of these firms, or at least of this firm, and I think they're actually just trying to protect the brand. Ironically, they're protecting the brand in precisely the wrong way by offering feedback to the company in a very public forum, which is damaging the brand. But if you look at the customers and you look at their purchasing behavior, they're great customers, just bad reviewers.
Well, then, it would appear that even if the Attorney General of New York State is successful in his case and somehow eradicates all paid sock puppets from review boards of all retailers, the majority of fake reviews still won't disappear from the face of the earth.
That is what probably concerned us the most about the results of our study. It's perhaps not surprising to us that firms are going to behave strategically to boost their own ratings or lower the ratings of their competitors. But these are customers doing this for no apparent financial reason. And so it suggests that this may be a lot more prevalent than we would otherwise expect.
All right, Duncan, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Duncan Simister is a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management. As of last week, election season is officially underway in India, where two men are vying to be the next prime minister of the world's largest democracy. One is Rahul Gandhi, a last name you probably recognize. The other is strident Hindu nationalist Narendra Modi. Modi has been dogged by allegations that he fueled religious riots in his home state of Gujarat in 2002 that killed as many as 1,000 Muslims. That part of his resume is cause for even more than usual concern, because the next prime minister will inherit the biggest national ID program in human history. As OTM producer Jamie York learned on a trip to India this summer, Americans are hardly alone in worrying about the potential abuse of personal data.
In 2009, Nanda Nilekani wrote Imagining India, 600 pages of positive thinking about what India could achieve. Nilekani was the billionaire co-founder of one of India's great tech success stories, Infosys. He wrote that information technology and the lessons of the private sector could be brought to bear on India's most intractable problems: poverty, corruption, poor education. On The Daily Show, Jon Stewart remarked on Nilekani's optimism.
We've always viewed a country of a billion people as a detriment.
Mm-hmm. That's the big change. I think we saw it as a burden. Now we see it as human capital.
In his book, he suggests that a good first step in making the most of India's human capital would be for India to figure out just how much of it there is. Its population of 1.2 billion people is projected to overtake China's in 15 years, yet India keeps slipshod birth records. The census tries to count only the number and types of households. Only 32 million pay taxes. India has more poor than the 26 poorest African countries combined. But the government cannot effectively provide social welfare because the poorest Indians, indeed most Indians, are simply invisible to the government.
And therefore, having the ID system as the underlying architecture for deployment, make sure that it goes to the right person, make sure it goes to only genuine people.
That's Nanda Nilekani. He said that everyone in India should get a unique 12-digit ID number using a scan of what are called biometrics, fingerprints, and irises. With that number, the nation could better direct and track billions of dollars in public assistance.
The government of India spends large amounts of money in terms of entitlements and benefits. They could be scholarships, pensions, subsidized rice, guaranteed employment, fuel, and so on. This runs into billions and billions of dollars.
India's prime minister called Nilekani's bluff and proposed that Nilekani head up a national ID program. So Nilekani left the company that had made him a billionaire and in 2009 set up the Part Public, Part Private Unique Identity Authority of India, or Aadhaar, Hindi for Foundation.
So far, we have enrolled around 450 million people and issued the numbers to 370 million people.
That's about a third of India's population voluntarily enrolled in just 4 years.
Son of Pitaji's name is Kesar Dayu.
Registration is being done by a web of private contractors, and it can happen anywhere, at a bank or a post office, traveling tent or a fixed office, like the one I visited on a hot July day in Delhi. There was a line out the door. A young girl was getting her fingerprint scanned as a handheld device scanned her irises. Her parents offered her personal info, which was typed into a laptop. It all took about 10 minutes. She'll be mailed her final unique ID number once the database is checked to make sure she hasn't been registered before. Behind her was a man in his 60s who had to guess at his birth date, and so forth and so on. When I asked people why they were volunteering to get the ID number, most answered like this.
This is his identity, he says, and that is he's from India. So that is why he's getting it made.
In the slick ads that are on TV, radio, and newspapers, buses, billboards, banners across the road here, the point of registering with Aadhaar is vague but inclusive. Join us in being an Indian. But the prime motivation is probably the reason this man volunteered to get his eyes scanned today.
He doesn't have an account
in the bank, so it is essential for him to get Aadhaar done, UID done.
The number will allow the poorest to get a bank account, most for the first time.
Suppose you want to withdraw money from your bank account, which you received from the government. You use your fingerprint or your iris, you authenticate, and then you withdraw your money. That ensures that only you withdraw your own money. It's linked to an identity. So obviously, once you do that, it streamlines the thing, reduces diversion, and ensures that the genuine people get the benefit.
Diversion is a nice way of saying stolen. Nobody knows how much of India's aid for the poor is siphoned off due to corruption, but it's a massive, vexing problem. Nilekani argues that India can never pull itself out of poverty if it doesn't create a foolproof ID, a digital system for getting aid directly into a bank account. But any stab at a solution on such a massive scale comes with its own problems.
Because even on such scale, if you enrolled 400 million people, and even if you had a 1% error, that's 4 million errors.
So let's say there is a 1% error rate. What do those 4 million people do when they're misidentified? Malavika Jayaram is a lawyer, a member of the Center for the Internet and Society, and a doctoral candidate who's been studying Aadhaar. She says that, well, nobody knows.
There isn't a law that governs it. If you want to roll out something this ambitious, it needs to be underpinned by a set of legal rules that say what you can and can't do with the data, who can see it, when do you delete it, what happens if there's a mistake, can someone go and have it corrected, what is the redress if that doesn't happen, what are the remedies open to them, what if there's identity theft, what if their data is stolen.
Well, in fact, I wrote to the government 3 years back saying that we should have such a law. So that's, again, in process.
The breakneck speed with which his idea went from his imagining to the largest biometric ID program in history means that some of the finer points weren't ironed out first.
Given that we want to, in the long run, have a regulatory authority to manage this whole thing and have that, we have proposed a bill, a UIDI bill, which is currently with the government and will be debated in due course in the parliament.
Aadhaar is unique in that it was approved by the prime minister, but not by India's Congress. So what happens when the prime minister changes next year? Nilekani says we need to see Aadhaar's data collection as a small part of a much bigger issue.
I would say that on balance, the information which is available here is less than what your mobile phone company knows today, far less. So I think that's what I'm saying. We have to look at this as a much larger issue. Any country or government has to put in place the checks and balances for using the digital data in ways that are not the way they were intended. But I'm just saying that applies to everything. And in fact, some of those other things are actually more dangerous.
Invoking cell phone data is instructive. India's got close to 90% cell phone usage. Clearly, like the rest of the world, Indians have chosen to ignore certain privacy concerns in favor of convenience. Likewise, no one forces you to get an Aadhaar ID, but try living without one. Jairam.
You can't get a phone without one. You can't get a driver's license without one. You can't open a bank account without one. Certain government jobs say that, you can't get your pension unless you have the number. So I think it makes a mockery of the voluntary nature of it. If you make it impossible for me to function without this.
And when citizens are compelled to register with a public-private partnership that lacks clear rules.
You are effectively changing the social contract. People may trust governments in a way that they don't trust the private sphere. So I think expecting people to just agree to a scheme because it's their government no longer is valid when it's not their government implementing it. People need to have the freedom to opt in or opt out. They need to have the freedom to know what decision to make, and they need to have the information.
Nilekani's response is, wait, let's remember, this is a discrete set of information taken for a specific purpose.
This is not a biometric system being done from a security perspective, but to make delivery of public services to the poor and the marginalized and the disenfranchised, making that better.
The information collected is limited to your biometrics, your name, address, age, gender, and phone number. But the assurance that this info will be used by Aadhaar solely to verify the delivery of aid and services, it's just that, an assurance. There's no law, little check on it being shared one day with other parts of government, law enforcement, border security. Jairam says that while Indians are generally quite trusting of government, they have good reason to be cautious.
In Gujarat, several years ago, when you had ethnic riots between Hindus and Muslims, it was the voter ID card that actually helped them know who was a Hindu and who was a Muslim, and which neighborhoods were predominantly Hindu and Muslim, and it helped to actually target people in a much more ruthless and effective way.
Ethnic and religious attacks are alarmingly common in India. In the 2002 Gujarat riots, roughly 1,000 people, mostly Muslims, were killed in a single week. Aadhaar doesn't collect the religious or caste data that's usually the flashpoint in this kind of mass murder, but it doesn't have to. Caste and religion often are obvious from your name. Tie that to your address, and it's understandable why some may fear the registry. And Jairam says that your religious identity is just the tip of the iceberg.
I think one of the craziest conferences that I ever attended was the LGBT community in Bangalore decided to have a meeting to discuss the fact that your gender field when you applied for the card was actually you could do male, female, or T for transgender. And they said, well, that's pretty progressive and it sounds very cool and very unlike, India to do this. So I inherited certain property from my family because I was the oldest son. I'm now turning into a woman. What does that do to my property rights? Under my community or under this kind of religious law, women don't inherit anything. So do I lose all my land?
Nilekani gets frustrated with all the quibbling about hypotheticals. What the law doesn't safeguard yet.
The law not being passed it has to happen, but it does not mean that we should stop giving benefits to people. It's a trade-off which is well worth it. I mean, there are 450 million people who are voting yes.
But can a high-tech solution really strike at the root of the deep-rooted, low-tech problem of corruption? Nilekani's argument boils down to this. You won't know until you try.
The fact is, I'm in the real world. I'm actually getting it done. I can always create a theoretical, ideal world which says that's better than this physical reality. You end up creating a bias for inaction.
Jayaram isn't having it.
Because once your data's out there, you can't get it back.
She thinks it's a false choice between taking action now or waiting for regulation. She says India's dire poverty and corruption make these false choices all too common.
I can see why someone who is hungry isn't thinking beyond their next meal, and something as nebulous and, you know, philosophical and ephemeral is not of great concern to them until they've eaten. But you have a spectrum of choices in achieving goals. And there are ways that you can manage that trade-off. You can have security and, you know, be able to eat. You can have privacy and have transparency. You can have both.
It's a fascinating debate, but one that India is just now beginning to have. And though press coverage has only lately started criticizing Aadhaar, no matter the criticism or the mistakes, Aadhaar may quite possibly already be too big to fail. Malavika Jayaram is hoping its size can be used against it, that the inevitable mistakes will mount until India recognizes that it was folly to think that one system, no matter how high-tech, could root out a force like corruption. Meanwhile, on a blazing Delhi day in July, the line of Indians looking to join the Aadhaar experiment extends out the door. For On the Media, I'm Jamie York. ये है मेरी पहचान ये है मेरी
पहचान. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Laura Mayer. We had more help from Zach Spencer and Megan Tian, with special thanks to Krista Marr in India. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Dunn and Ken Feldman.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.